this is Jerry Pippin, and the year was 1949. The music you hear in the background was by one of the big bands that was popular at the time, Les Brown and his band of renown. On major market radio stations everywhere late nights in 1949, whether the weather was warm or cold, the idea was that any radio listener could visit some of the top night spots in the country and hear some of the big bands doing their thing. However, in Berkeley, in the San Francisco Bay Area, there was a different kind of programming on a small radio station sponsored by the public with no commercials. Alternative radio was something brand new in 1949. The programming? They did have entertainment, but mostly it was stimulating intellectual talk. Our guest today is one of radio's prominent historians, Brian DeShazor, and we'll be talking with Brian about programming on the legendary WBAI in New York, along with the programs on the other four Pacifica radio stations, including Los Angeles and San Francisco. Brian, welcome to the show, and I guess we should start with the fact that the first time your station came to my attention was in the San Francisco Bay Area back in the 60s, and I believe it was about that time when you got in trouble with the FCC over George Carlin and his recording of the seven words you can't say on the air. I mean, can you do that now?
And are you putting this back in on this 42 hours?
I don't think you can say those words yet, can you? Or at least not all of them.
Not even in three, even in the safe harbor land, there's still some that, you know, is still risky because it was, and it's risky because it really wasn't about a word that he had in the poem, but it was about the ideas that he presented. It was about the thoughts that it provoked in the public. So that's why it's still such a gray area.
Not even at 3 a.m.
Appropriate for public air or not.
The Pacifica programs get streamed on the internet?
Yes, at Pacifica.org and the five Pacifica stations, you can podcast, or they're podcasting a lot of the programs. The Pacifica archives, if you go to supportpra.org, supportpra.org, you'll find some of our restored programs, and you'll be able to listen to some of those via a stream or podcast some of the programs of our weekly radio series called From the Vault. And if you go to fromthevaultradio.org, you'll look at the...
Now, are you involved in that weekly
yes,
production?
Yes, I host and I executive produce, and then
I host. I knew you hosted, but I didn't know if that... But you're actually a hands-on
yes,
guy.
Yes, we go in weekly discussions on what the next subject is, what did we find, what people are thinking about to go look for. You know, it's a weekly research problem. You know, if you go into college and do your research paper, it's like doing a research paper every single week. Because once we find the subject matter, then we have to go and find out all about it and present it and to the listening audience that's best in the public interest.
Now, you mentioned Pete Seeger, and he has a big history, of course, in the music business and the entertainment business in a commentary of life.
Mm-hmm.
He lives up, I think, in upstate New York now.
Right, Beacon, New York. What we did is we engaged Tim Robbins, the actor and director, Academy Award winning.
I know who.
Oh, who he is. For the listeners who, the three listeners who might not know that. Tim Robbins, you know, went and visited Pete Seeger with us at his home in Beacon, New York. So we recorded and filmed a 5-hour interview of Pete telling the story of his life. And then we went back into our special Pacifica Radio archives. And whenever he spoke about Woody Guthrie, whenever he spoke about Rosa Parks, whenever he spoke about Dr. Martin Luther King, and whenever he spoke about the environmental movement that he was a part of, and the House on American Activities Committee that convicted Pete Seeger, all of those historical moments are documented in our archive. So we took all the voices of Rosa Parks and Hugh Eck and Martin Luther King Jr., and we infused them in this story. And we took archival footage of when Pete was at Pacifica in New York City in 1962, introducing the public to Bob Dylan singing Blowin' in the Wind for the very first time. So as you listen to this documentary that we're presenting, it really is the story of the last half of the 20th century as seen by Pete Seeger, a man whose optimism and music has really sort of guided him through some very troubled waters in his life and has managed to come out still hoping for the best in humans.
When we talk about Pacifica itself, KPFA in Berkeley was your first station.
Right.
And do you still have things originating from Berkeley?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Berkeley station does go back to 1949, so we still get materials. In fact, we just rescued some tapes from a basement that had been flooded in Berkeley just last April, and they were the recordings of the San Francisco Film Festival from 1968 on. So we just now rescued and restored audio of interviews with Betty Davis and Shelley Winters and Burt Lancaster and directors like Akira Kurosawa and, you know, some important historic figures in the film world, which, you know, is the sort of 20th and 21st century's art form.
Studs Terkel is an incredible talent, naturally, and deals with words better than almost anyone. What does he do in this series?
Studs Terkel, you know, has been, you know, even though he's out of Chicago and has hosted the radio show for many, many decades, Studs Terkel is, you know, well aware of the wealth of our audio archive. You know, he's been on the air with us many times and talking about historic figures and poets and, you know, really he tells the story of the century much better than anybody else. So what we've done, he's given us permission to use some of his interviews that were significant in his life. So again, we tell the story of the century using his interviews with Mahalia Jackson and Dr. Martin Luther King and Muhammad Ali and Zira Mostel and Dorothy Parker. So again, we sort of see a weaving of fabric of how these interviews and how these audio archives tell our story, and how that this is not just an archive that records the document, you know, records the broadcast history of a company or a media network. It's much more than that. Because of the free speech common denominator, all these interviews and conversations and radio drama and art, all of this really is so unmediated and so raw that the conversations are far more interesting to scholars and historians than if they were under the guise of, you know, selling the hot dog.
Yeah, you got a good point there. When you talk about Pacifica and its history, I mean, just the idea of what it's been doing, it's been kind of radio-free America.
Right, there were even times when the clocks were not allowed inside the studio because they didn't want to be confined by, you know, the beginning of a program and the end of a program. So clocks were banned from the studio time, and the rule of thumb was the program is over when the conversation is over. Well, I can only imagine what the TV executives would say to that these days.
Well, it's an interesting concept. And, you know, basically, you talk about the clock. We live and die by it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And over the years, I guess I've gotten used to the clock being my prompter to keep the show moving, you know. But it would be kind of a nice luxury to just be able to go on and
right,
on and on.
Some of my favorite recordings are of Kenneth Rexroth, who was a beat poet in San Francisco. And he had a show in the early years of Pacifica where he was a book reviewer. But he never actually read the books before he got on the air.
So he'd read the book.
So you can actually hear on the air him, like, tearing the wrapper off of the cover of the book and reading the cover of the book and reading the first page of the book. And basically that was his review. But, you know, really, he just went on and on and on and, you know, sort of skimmed through it and then reviewed it, like, right in real time.
You know, people these days don't remember those early days of radio, but speech and talking was very important even then. Talk radio, of course, is big today, but it's totally different than what it was back then. Thank God that it was originally very erudite and, in my opinion, very informing and very entertaining. Now it's kind of off in its own la-la land with its own little target audience. But the reason I bring this up, there were people like on WBBM in Chicago, a guy who used to just come on for 15 minutes and talk. And so that was not an unusual format. The only thing unusual about it was you guys didn't limit them to 15 minutes. You let them talk and
right,
talk and talk.
You mentioned target audiences, too, and this sort of like goes back to this idea idea of no clocks in the studios at Pacifica at one time. But also the target audience was never really seen as a viable way to judge the strength of programming. You know, they sort of like said, thought that if you started targeting audiences, that's when you sort of start confining and disenfranchising certain people.
I agree.
Like, say if you have a Latino audience that you're trying to reach, and you have Latino subject matters and Latino music and Latino commentators and Latino pundits, you have your target audience and your target host. But what the audience is not getting is European literature, African-American literature, African-American opinion, conversations with Malcolm X, conversations with, you know, Madeline Murray O'Hare, an atheist, you know, spiritual people like the Dalai Lama or Jay Krishnamurti. You know, so early in the Pacifica land, there were no schedules other than this is a program, this is a program, this is a program. It wasn't, this is your audience, this is your program, perfect for you. Listen now, but don't listen ever anywhere else. The idea was everybody gets to listen to everything, and you judge when you want to come back and listen.
Well, that's one of the reasons we started on the Internet 7 years ago, is mass appeal radio really gone by the way. And so we have different segments for different parts of the audience. I can choose what they want to, download it, podcast, whatever. And that's a great freedom. And so really, with Pacifica, I guess if you had to come up with a word to describe what they do, freedom would be
it. Yeah, I think that First Amendment, it really is like First Amendment radio, because, you know, even, you know, there is a preconceived notion, people that are familiar with Pacifica, that think it's the communist station. When I came into Pacifica 9 years ago, I was unfamiliar with it, and I was told that's the communists, don't go there. But, you know, looking in the archives and being the director of the archives and really understanding the mission statement of listener-sponsored media, no corporations, no underwriting, nobody gets to decide by their dollar what goes on the air, that's extraordinary. And it's extraordinary that they allowed communist commentators on the air, not to preach or to lobby or to convince people that this is the way, but to dialogue. They're like right-wing Christians on the communist hour. The communists were talking about the Black Panther Party movement. The communists were talking about democracy. The communists were talking about Vietnam. So these different opinions and perspectives and viewpoints of the world is what Pacifica's mission is. And when you take that First Amendment and take that First Amendment in its entirety, and you do not chop anything off of that amendment, if you use it as powerfully as it was written, then what we get is a truth that is unvarnished.
Now, when we talk about Pacifica out of the past, and that's what you're dealing with this 42-hour program, how about Pacifica today? You've been there 9 years. Any changes? Or are they doing business basically the way they were founded?
Right, you know, there has been some struggles. I think I think it was in 2000, there was a move to mainstream Pacifica's programming. Again, they sort of like target the audience and confine it and sort of like put it into this mainstream model. And activists took it back. And the Foundation is the first democratically run media organization in the world. So now we have like 24 board members that represent all listener areas. So their listeners are elected, and then they govern. Then they help govern the policies of Pacifica. So that is a
when you say elected, you have subscriptions, right?
Right. Like if you're a paying member or a donor to Pacifica, then you get the right to vote for the leadership of Pacifica, who helps get to decide.
So it's basically very democratic.
Yeah, absolutely.
With the people who are paying. But anybody, of course, can listen to it.
Anybody can listen to it. But, you know, even with democracy, as we're seeing in the government of democracy, Pacifica is always going to struggle because it still is that staunch supporter of that First Amendment right.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you'll be okay if you don't get in some electronic voting machines.
That's about right. It's about as relevant as it is. You know, with the relevance of that you mentioned, Jerry, the Fannie Lou Hamer, the great civil rights leader who helped voter registration in Mississippi in the 60s, we have more audio of her than anyone in the world. And when she tells a story about how she had to fight and struggle and get beaten up just to register to vote,
And then you see 40% of the people even bother. It's amazing.
Right. Yeah, not only the respect that the citizenry of this country has for their right to vote, that, you know, that's disturbing on the outset. But then we have the same problem of voters dismissed by ethnic and racial and economic, you know, factors.
My opinion on that is that this is the super right doing this, and they basically push nationalism and patriotism, and they're basically spitting in the face of every military person that ever died in any combat, because the right to vote was, if you ask any of those GIs what they were doing, that's one of the things they would have been doing, is trying to preserve democracy. And, you know, they're just destroying the whole thing. It's very, very upsetting, and really, somebody needs to be punished for it. It needs to be stopped.
Right, and I think...
And I didn't mean to get on my soapbox.
Well, right. No, you're absolutely right, and you have every right to. You have freedom of speech, sir.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I think what my job is, in that, you know, we do have a problem, our country can be much better. You know, I can't be the one to spend my energies complaining and looking at all the bad things that are happening in our country, but what I can do is shine light on the history that this archive has to present, that we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time that a Congress changes over or that the president changes over, because our history is behind us. Our ancestors are behind us. Our ancestors have spoken and fought and yes, died for the right to vote. You know, when I listen to a suffragette being interviewed in 1960, at maybe she was like 90 years old, she actually like marched in the streets and got beaten by a pole by a man because she wanted the right to vote. That makes me weep when I think of young women who don't take advantage of that right.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just, we can get into all the kind of reasons, but Pacifica, to your credit, is pushing free speech, giving all kinds of viewpoints, and when they listen to this 42 hours, it's entertaining.
Oh, absolutely.
Too, right?
I think that the producers that work with the archival material, we do have a style, if you will, in how we curate it, that, you know, we don't want to, you know, bore the people to tears. And we also don't want to use it as a history lesson. This isn't like going to a history class, but it's experiential in that we know that the sound of the human voice recorded and played certain voices and certain these voices, really, it's the breath of God. That's the root of the word voice. That what we have is a record of a human being, human beings that teach us something. You know, so we curate it in a way that the listener experiences these people and the times that they lived in, what they went through, and how they became empowered to be at the microphone.
With today's multi-channel universe, multimedia universe, how's Pacifica holding up audience-wise? You think you still got a good form?
Yeah. Actually, I think that Pacifica's getting stronger and stronger. We have 100 affiliate stations nationwide. When I came in 10 years ago, throughout that period, we were down to like 30. So with the newly democratically run Pacifica, a lot more community stations are willing to jump on board and join the experiment.
Okay, November 28th and 29th starts at 3 a.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. 6 a.m. Eastern.
Listeners can stream the whole broadcast on supportpra.org.
And in addition to that, it goes right straight through for 42 hours. So that starts, what time of the night?
The 29th. They're going to be rolling. So it's the 3 a.m. the morning of the 28th, and then it stops at 8 p.m. on the 29th.
Okay.
Time.
So 3 a.m. on the 28th, right to the 8 o'clock hour. Is that your time, Pacific time?
Pacific time, right?
Yeah,
so.
Right. I've enjoyed it. What about your own ambitions? You're pretty happy, I take it.
I think that, you know, this is definitely the leap year, red letter year for the Pacifica Archives. I've been invited by the Library of Congress's Recorded Sound Preservation Board to testify in their public hearings on the state of audio sound preservation in the United States. So we really have the opportunity now to elevate this archive to a national treasure, which is sort of the ultimate reward for myself and for the work of this incredible staff that works in the archive. It's not just me, of course.
When you were growing up and before you took the job at Pacifica, were you interested in radio history?
Not at all. I was completely inexperienced in radio, inexperienced.
You know, that may have actually been an asset.
Right. I think so, because you know, what I did was really start listening to the audio, and I learned. I mean, I heard so much. I really, you know, I tell people that, you know, I never went to college, but I have a four-year college education in social sciences and in human.
You have a much better education than people who pay for it.
Well, I now go and lecture at universities. I've lectured at UCLA and University of Pennsylvania. I've lectured at Howard University. I've lectured in the universities because this thing is so big.
The reason I ask you that, if you had a predetermined idea, is because of the ramp Pacifica had with the communists. You figure you listen to Norman Thomas. I think he was on their station, son.
Right.
It's not really what you heard, even when you hear what they're saying.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, so basically, you go in there with an open mind, you probably get a pure idea of the conflicts and the, I guess, the driving thing that is America, really, or should be, and it's been stifled. It's been stifled not only by government, but mainly by corporations.
Right. These recordings, you know, there's something, you know, when you step into something that says, you know, they're the communist station, there's an anxiety and a fear about what I'm going to hear. You know, growing up, communist came up, it was simply demonized.
Yeah, it was completely demonized. They still use it, the right wing uses it, and there's probably not a communist in 1,000 miles in the sense they're talking about.
And I bet you can't find 5 people in the street that can tell you what the Communist Manifesto is or what it means or why it failed in Russia or what people actually think about it, which is why when I started listening to the recordings, I'm not a communist. I'm a registered Democrat and whatever that is, it is. But what I learned from these recordings is that communism as an ideology or a theory or what a political party is not a scary thing. I mean, these were human beings that had their own opinions about things. That's the important part.
It was the unintended consequences, in my opinion, of power. And the power on the other side combating the idea that people would have a voice. We still have that same battle going on, different labels.
So it's always important to remember our past so that we don't repeat it.
Well, I enjoyed the conversation. Anything else you want to add?
No, I don't think so. Everybody has our website. I invite them all to listen in on the day or check out our website meantime to help donate.
I have one final question. What's your next project?
Next project is a lot of grant work. I think we have, you know, if we get the funds that we're looking forward to, the project is doing a major selection of tapes and getting them preserved and being able to report that back to.
I want to ask you one other thing. Because of budget, Pacifica, I've always thought of them as being somebody with a guitar in a studio singing folk songs or somebody talking. And now you have Miriam Makeba at the Coconut Grove, and you say Lena Horne was there and introduced
her.
Right?
She does, and it was a fun drive for.
You know, a lot of people don't understand how big the Coconut Grove was at one time. When I first moved to L.A. Many years ago, I went over there to the Coconut Grove. It was closed. It was not renovated or anything. It was one of the periods when it was really down. And I had some people take my picture on stage just so I could say, hey, Jerry Pippen appeared on the Coconut Grove. Okay, so I'm a little eccentric. But anyway... so there's all kinds of things we're going to hear on this 42 hours.
Yes.
Thanks a lot. Oh, yeah, my first love, radio and radio history. Pacifica, interesting group and interesting history. It goes all the way back to 1949. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippen, thanking you for listening. Pleasant memories and cheers.